Hi, thank you all for coming. My name is Susan Kismarek, and I am a curator in the Department of Photography here at the museum, and I organize the exhibition Present Tense, Photographs by Joanne Verberg. I want to begin with these two photographs that you see on the screen. The one on the left was made by William Henry Jackson, who was one of a number of great 19th century landscape photographers who went out to the American West to photograph for the United States government. They were enlisted as survey photographers by the government, usually places like the U.S. Geological Survey, to understand what the landscape looked like, to make pictures that the officials back in Washington could use to help determine where railroads might go, where mining might be done, where communities might be built. The one on the left is by Jackson, and it's called Moraines on Clear Creek, Valley of the Arkansas, Colorado, and it was made in 1873. There wasn't only William Henry Jackson, there was also Timothy O'Sullivan and Andrew Russell, among others. The picture on the right was made by Joanne Verberg and Mark Klett some 104 years later of the same exact site. It's called Clear Creek Reservoir, Colorado, and it was made in 1977. And you can see why there's a title change. Obviously, the river in the left-hand picture by Jackson has been dammed up, and we now have a reservoir. I thought that I'd begin with these two pictures, for starters. Not the least of reason it was because it's always fun to see before and after images. I'm sure you've seen them in other contexts within magazines and newspapers. And I think it's also one of the wonderful things that photography can do, which is to describe the world to us, the real world, with a kind of authority that I don't think any other medium has, except perhaps obviously film. So in other words, you know, that's what it looked like. And the picture on the right says, that's what it looks like now. And that's kind of a wonderful thing to be able to go in time that way. But more importantly, I begin with these two pictures because they really are a foundation of the conceptual superstructure that Joanne's subsequent 30 years of photographs are based on, and I'll explain why in a minute. First, I wanted to talk a little bit about the cultural and artistic environment that surrounded Joanne when she came of age as an artist. She was born in 1950, which means that she was about 18 years old in 1968. And that was the year that saw the assassinations of Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King, violence at the Democratic National Convention, widespread demonstrations against the war in Vietnam, the emergence of a hippie counterculture and the Black Power movements, the riots in France that nearly toppled the French government, and the beginnings of the women's movement and the environmental movement. I don't think the word environment was on anybody's no one ever used the word, I don't think, until beginning in the 1970s, and now, of course, we use it all the time. All of these things were going on, and Joanne went to college as a sociology major at Wesleyan University in Ohio, and it was obviously a time of enormous social, cultural, and political rest in the United States and around the world. And this throwing off of accepted ideas was also true in the art world. And performance, installation art, site-specific pieces, and women artists came to the fore, making a more permanent place on the artistic map for generations to come. Verberg was influenced, very much influenced, by these activities, and their effect on her formative years as an artist determined her understanding of how photographs might engage the viewer. And let me just digress from my text a little bit to talk additionally, to sort of set the sort of environment, or describe the environment at the times more in terms of photography. There was an interesting confluence of activities in the 1970s and into the early 1980s that, in addition to what I've already described, I think helped set created an environment for people like Joanne and other photographers to begin working. The mid-1970s was really when the art world began to be interested in photography as a medium. And the reasons for this were varied, and they sort of range from high and low to low reasons. One of them was that a lot of artists, as I've described, and I'll show works, that's the setup for the next picture. But what was going on in photography, or what was going on in the art world, was that artists were making, where they were doing performance, they were making site-specific pieces. If you think of Spiral Jetty, if you think of installation art, et cetera, these things couldn't be collected. So I came to the museum in 1976, and these kinds of activities were going on. But what it meant was that the art galleries, the art market, couldn't sell. I mean, who can buy Spiral Jetty? You know, you couldn't buy a performance piece. I mean, now a lot of times these things are documented by video, and in fact, decades later, we're presented with portfolios of a lot of these documentations of performance pieces. But the point is that in the 1970s, I saw it myself, the art world turned to photography as a collectible, and they turned to prints also. I mean, I can remember the first photo exhibition at Sonnabend Gallery, which had never shown photography, and it was, in fact, a portfolio that was done by Henri Magritte. Someone had found negatives that he had made, very much in keeping with what his paintings look like, and had posthumously printed this portfolio of Magritte photographs. So that there was that. There was the fact that artists were making art that wasn't collectible. So there was this new attention to photography that in contemporary times had not occurred. I mean, obviously, historically, there were exhibitions of photographs in institutions, and there was collecting. I mean, if you think of Stieglitz 291, et cetera, et cetera. The other couple of things that went on, there were two very important books that were written. One was Susan Sontag's On Photography, which had been published in serial form in the New York Review of Books in, I think, from 76 to 77, and which, of course, became a seminal text that, in fact, ended up determining a lot of thinking about photography, especially within academic circles for the next 25 years. And also in 1977, John Szarkowski published his book, Looking at Photographs, which I think was perhaps one of the most, I know it was one of the most popular books about photography in that time, but it presented 100 photographs from the museum's collection, and John wrote a text about each photograph that was presented in the book adjacent to the photograph. And they were very personal, almost rhapsodic, but wonderful appreciations of the picture that you were looking at. And obviously, there are many other things that were going on, but these were three crucial parts or things about photography that were going on in the 70s that helped create this atmosphere for people like Joanne to begin working. So this realigning of the stars, so to speak, was also true in photography, because up to that point, at museums, collecting, whatever, there was a photography gallery in New York called the Witkin Gallery, which I think started in the late 50s through the 60s. This is what was understood as art photography, and this, of course, is Henri Cartier-Bresson's Behind the Gare Saint-Lazare in Paris in 1932, and it really does exemplify the best of what was regarded at that time as fine art photography. But with all of these new forms of artistic invention, there was a renewed interest in photography as an art form, and all of these things that I've described resulted in a kind of discovery and rediscovery of photographic history, hence the reason for the Verberg and Mark Collette project, the Rephotographic Survey project. Again, this is what was understood as art photography, and what happened was during that period, because people started making other kinds of photographs, was that photography was released from the grip of this 35 millimeter, do not crop, Cartier-Bresson aesthetic. Joanne describes photography like this, which she clearly respects, as do I, more than you might imagine from the things that I've been saying. But Joanne describes this as an aha moment. In other words, it's a picture where the confluence activity and the forms create a new meaning that's identifiable, and it's apart from what was photographed. And this artistic atmosphere that I described allowed photographers, by bringing attention to the medium, for them to go back and look at photographic history, not only work by photographers who people had not been aware of, from which they could learn, because I do believe in a tradition of photography wherein artists learn from those who have gone before, obviously not simply to copy, but to understand how they might make something different, how they can depart from what was done. So let me show you two kinds of pictures that were made that illustrate this idea that I'm talking about. This one was made by him, and this was typical of the period. He enlisted two photographers. Unfortunately, I don't have their names. They did not become noted art photographers, so to speak. But this picture is from a portfolio that is attributed to Rudolf Schwarzkogler, and it's a group of pictures that he made in 1965, and it's a documentation of a performance that he did with one other person called Axion Hochzeit, which I believe translates as wedding action. Schwarzkogler was a member of the Vienna Actionists, which was a loosely aligned group. They weren't a formal group that helped develop the idea of action art. And if you're familiar with that, you know that fluxus, happenings, performance, and body art were also part of this movement. And the main proponents were four artists in Vienna who were active between 1960 and 71. And their work is best remembered for the transgressive nature of it, wherein there were naked bodies, there was a lot of destruction, there was a fair amount of violence. And what it documents is this pseudo-wedding, and it included a lot of food, the throwing of the paint, et cetera, et cetera. The second photograph I'd like to show you that helps describe other kinds of pictures. This is a fascinating project that was done by the American photographers Mike Mandel and Larry Sultan. They did a project which was both an exhibition and a book called Evidence in 1977. This renewed interest in photographic history also created, vis-a-vis John Tchaikovsky's book and Susan Sontag's book, thinking about photography in a way that I don't believe we experienced, especially since World War II. What Mandel and Larry Sultan did was that they went through the files of police offices, corporate file cabinets, and municipal archives, and they presented the photographs without captions. And in so doing, what happens is that what gets revealed is photography's inherent surrealist quotient. And what the pictures do is they emphasize how the accidental and what I think are often intriguing and mystifying images can result. And they're simply a result of these accidental implications rising from what were factual images. When I secured this picture for reproduction in the catalog, I called Larry, who I know, and I said, do you know, because I looked in the back of the book and I thought, they listed all the archives and the places where the pictures had come, but they didn't list the captions, even in the back of the book. So I said, do you know what this was? I'm writing about the picture. And he couldn't remember. So we can sit here and we can make up what this was. I mean, you know, perhaps it's a medical photograph. Perhaps this woman had some condition with her hands and there's a kind of measuring going on of something. I don't think we can ever know. And the book, it's a wonderful book, and it was actually, the whole project was acquired by the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art about 5 years ago, and I think that the book was republished. But it really underscores this incredible capacity of the medium, not only to describe what we saw in the sort of before and after views that are totally believable, but this ability to create images that are absolutely intriguing. And it helps underscore how we project onto the photograph meaning. Okay, back to Mr. Jackson and Ms. Verberg and Mr. Klett. One of the other things I remember about the 1960s and 70s was that there was a lot of money that was filtering through the culture and through from the government. And this often went to Head Start programs and daycare centers and to art centers and storefronts and such. And the National Endowment for the Arts at the time was very involved with providing money. And in fact, when I came here, they provided a yearly stipend for an intern. And there were many people, there were a good, I think, 10 or so people who were trained to work with photographs within a museum context through this NEA fellowship. And many of them have gone on to curatorial positions in other museums. But one of the other things that the NEA did during this period, aside from sponsoring exhibitions, was that they sponsored surveys. There were a couple. One was done by the Seagram Corporation, and I think they got some money from the NEA to photograph county courthouses around the United States. But one of the other projects that they funded was the one that Joanne Verberg and Mark Klett did, called the Refotographic Survey Project. And it was almost a kind of obsessive project. It's hard to believe that people at this point in time would actually have the time and patience to do this. But Joanne, along with Mark Klett, who is a photographer and still working as a photographer, and a photo historian named Ellen Manchester, in 1977, they got funding from the NEA, and they did a project to, quote, to provide some raw material for an investigation into the nature of photographic information, unquote. Over 3 years, they made some 120 updates of 19th century photographs, first taken by Henry Jackson, William Henry Jackson, O'Sullivan, Andrew Russell, and John Hillers. The original photographs were obviously made when the territories were unknown and uninhabited. So they got copy prints from the various government agencies that hold these original photographs. The National Archives is one of these places. Any one of us can go there and make an appointment and look at these pictures if you're really interested in photography and you're visiting Washington. In any case, they got copy prints from these original albums. They were often presented in albums so that the congressmen and officials could look at them more easily. They got copy prints of these pictures, and along with these copy prints in hand, plus maps and compasses, and they actually enlisted a geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, a man named Hal Malday, they found the exact same spot where the original photographer had stood. But not only did they find the exact same spot, they used not the same cameras, but the closest cameras, the closest lenses, and the closest film that would approximate the technology of the 19th century photographers. They waited for the same light, they photographed in the same season, they waited for the same weather conditions, so that the descriptions of the landscape and their updated photographs would be as close as possible to the original images. You understand that the people in the 19th century are still working, for the most part, with wet plate technology, which means that these guys who went out there had to actually bring, they were in covered wagons often, and they were using glass plates, so they would have to transport hundreds of glass plates very carefully to these very difficult to reach places. They would have to coat the plate before they inserted it into the camera. They'd make the picture and they would have to develop the plate right out there in the field. So obviously, Joanne and her friends weren't that crazy that they would try to simulate that or try to pay that close allegiance to the originals. But by eliminating elements of chance, I mean, for Verberg and Klett, that usually determine how a photograph can look, I think what happened is that they entered a kind of strange conceptual zone in which their pictures were the same, but they weren't the same. And obviously, a comparison of the two sets of pictures shows how the landscape has changed over the intervening century. And it also obviously gives us the elliptical before and after narrative that I spoke of previously. Clearly, there are verdant expanses that are obliterated by parking lots. There are rivers dammed to make reservoirs. Cars and railroads appear, and communities vanish or have been built. I have to say, it was surprising to me in going through the book. There are, I think, 120 comparisons that are reproduced. And there's much less. I mean, and clearly part of the impetus for this was about the environment, which was an important issue at the time. But there's a lot less destruction than you would think. It's more interesting that, in fact, there's like a small mining community in the 19th century picture. In the new picture, it's just landscape. It's less destructive than you might imagine. But this extended and exhaustive exercise that they performed was also instructive in another way, and I think for Verberg in a more important way, which has to do with investigating the process and the meaning of photography itself. Their close observation and experience of the permutations of photographic description available within the strict parameters of the 19th century commission gave Verberg and Klett a highly technical and intimate understanding of the visual possibilities available at each site. And more importantly, the exercise provided a 19th century visual superstructure rooted in the photographic technology and cultural thinking of that time, which was something quite different from the 1970s ideas about landscape photography. At that point, people like Robert Adams, among others, he's perhaps one of the more prominent people, began making photographs that described the uneasy relationship that we have with the landscape, especially in the United States. So that there was a concentration in landscape photography beginning in the 1970s that had to do with the destruction or the invasion of the landscape by people. Mark Klett, in describing the distance between the original and the modern survey photograph, wrote, quote, "Viewed in the same context, both photographs seem to extend beyond their own time frameworks and refer to an intervening period without actually describing a particular course of events. The earliest pictures mark the starting point, but no one image, first or latest in the series, represents a definitive statement. Each is simply another perspective in an ongoing time image network. The individual pictures are like single frames picked from a time-lapsed film. When they are viewed in succession, they give the appearance of time in motion, of continuous change," unquote. Now, for Joanne Verberg, this gap, I think, provided an intellectual and emotional space in which she would continue to work, making photographs that attempt to describe the kind of ineffability that gap contained. What takes place in the space between the two images is the passage of time and the progressive changes in the landscape, but the two images themselves are false, or at least arbitrary. They're arbitrary beginnings and ends. It's almost as though you have a shelf of books, and within the shelf of books, you place bookends randomly amidst them. These two random moments, which primarily depend on chance in their original conception as well as in the remade photograph, suggest an openness towards their nominal subject and a sense of endless possibilities. When seen together, the two pictures are less absolute conceptions than insistent indicators pointing to the before and after, thresholds to a future and a past. As arbitrary bookends, they provoke consideration of what is excluded. What lies to the left and the right of the bracketed row? What remains outside the excluded volumes on our bookshelf? This paradigm would remain the underpinning of much of Verberg's subsequent work, particularly in her use of multiple frames, which, like the rephotographed pictures and their originals, provide more than one viewpoint, albeit toward entirely different effects based on entirely different intentions. So let's see how this conceptual underpinning plays itself out in her subsequent photographic work. This piece, entitled With Michael and John in Minnesota from 1982, is one from a series of multiple frame portraits that Joanne began making in 1981. This three-part piece is typical of the series, and I think one of the most successful. She, Verberg herself, appears in the third frame, and the other two figures are the artist Mike Kelly and a painter who I think is still out in Minnesota named John Miller. And the work was made when all three of them were on a year-long stint as visiting artists at the Minneapolis College of Art. I think it's fair to say that the threesome are so artfully arranged that it seems as though they've appeared before the camera somewhat serendipitously. And it also seems as though the three views have been made with a single exposure. But of course, each arrangement was highly controlled by the photographer. For this series and for subsequent series, Joanne often makes drawings. So she somewhat conceptualizes what the photograph will look like before she actually makes the picture. In this piece, she choreographed the placement of the figures' heads across the three individual pictures and through the picture plane from foreground to background. She used severe cropping and shallow focus to further activate the visual range of the piece. As in all of her serial portraits, the picture suggests the tentative and tenuous connectedness, or lack thereof, between people who appear united by compositional resemblance and by the sense of psychological closeness that results. Here, the deliberate arbitrariness and temporal aspect of such relationships are enhanced by the two men looking off camera at the left and right-hand edges of the first and third pictures, their faces excluded from the frame by the edges of the prints, and by the repetition of body parts, their heads as well as the hands, which draw the viewer across the frames, with the gloved hand at the bottom left, which is actually Mike Kelly's glove propped on a stick. The piece is sculptural in the way that the figures are arranged within each picture's perimeter and the way they occupy the spaces allotted to them. And the varied compositional repetition from picture to picture indicates time, but not a linear narrative, much like the experimental dance performances Verberg was watching at the time, which created for her, quote, something more like dream time, within which past, present, and future exist simultaneously. And you'll see up in the exhibition, there's actually a photograph of two groups of visiting artists to Minneapolis, to the Walker Art Center. One is Robert Wilson and a group of performance dance artists, a group called Ping Chong, or the artist's name is Ping Chong, and it's his group. And then there's another one of Patricia Brown's dance company. As part of a threesome, no individual portrait is definitive, but together they create rather a finely sliced moment, and our engagement with them is immediate and visceral. As viewers, we're enticed by the formal beauty of the piece and activated to unravel its construction, just as we're motivated to reconcile the before and after views from the Rephotographic Survey project. As Verberg has said, quote, I want to provoke the viewer to literally have to take a stand, to move from one position to another in relation to the photographs and the people in my portraits. The people in my portraits are often life-size. To heighten the identification a viewer may feel with them and to force the viewer out of his or her normal viewing expectations. This is part and parcel of the atmosphere that I was describing, which had to do with activating the audience. And while Joanne, who studied, she actually went to graduate school at RIT, which is a school that's known for its technical training. And she also worked as an intern at the International Museum of Photography at George Eastman House. So her knowledge and her appreciation of photographic history is intense and thorough, and is the departure point for what she does. But this notion, these ideas about art that were occurring in the 1970s were extremely important in terms of how she proceeded to use photography. Viewed in the context of one work, each individual portrait appears in a specific moment. And the work implies the passage of time, but it also includes its sense of absence, the unrecorded moments between the pictures, so that the viewer takes in the portraits all at once, while imagining what might have happened between them, and becomes actively engaged in contemplating a kind of puzzle, just like the pairs from the two pictures from the Rephotographic Survey project. This is another example from the portrait series called Three Times Mike. This is Mike Kelly, the performance artist, or formerly performance artist, from 1982. And obviously, it's different from the one that I just showed in that it's of one individual, and I think, describes these nuanced moments. I don't know what the time lapse was between the pictures. It could have been a matter of seconds. It could have been a matter of minutes. One of the most powerful multi-part portraits made in this series, in my opinion, is one that Joanne made later in 1989, and it's of her husband, who is a poet. His name is Jim Moore. After she moved permanently to Minneapolis in 1983, they married. And at that time, her attention shifted from performance, dance, from more public displays and things out in the world in terms of subject matter, to the personal, to a separation from the world at large, to a place containing privacy, comfort, and a focus on human relationships. This space for her is a site of both containment and opportunity for, quote, moments of great concentration and privacy, unquote. These three views of her husband, Jim Moore, form a neat description of a seemingly ordinary moment imbued with existential insight about ourselves in relation to others. The three pictures, in fact, describe interstitial moments, moments not of self-awareness, but of private reverie or thought. The first two frames act like beats of anticipation before the third, which contains the moment of engagement between the subject and the camera, and of course, the viewer and the photograph. And one wonders what the subject is thinking in the two pauses before the action. The work's gravity lies, in my opinion, in the sorrow of our struggle and ultimate inability to transcend our fundamental aloneness, a knowledge that we share of each other, and it's made all the more poignant by the vulnerability of the man's naked shoulders. In its totality, the work describes and then engages our sense of Moore's existential aloneness. The individuality depicted in the first two frames is, in the third frame, interrupted and finally re-emphasized. The spiritual experience of an encounter with another person has been made visible and tangible. For me, it's difficult to imagine how a more insightful perception of human perception might be wrought, except perhaps in literature, probably in poetry. This is a deeply personal work that I feel barely endures our scrutiny. As viewers, we're complicit in the forced engagement between the photographer and subject and feel somehow like intruders. And in turn, the work functions much like the actual human experience of intimacy with another. It's like catching someone's eye when you're walking down the street or standing on the subway. And to capture such intimacy is unusual, especially in a work that appears spontaneous. Although, in fact, Joanne always works with a camera on a tripod and the subject was fully aware of being photographed and the picture-making process. And it's also remarkable that the three pictures were made without any other exposures, although the order that you see them in was not the order in which the pictures were made. It just goes to show you how underscores the discrepancy between what you think you're seeing in a photograph and what actually transpired in actuality when the picture was made. It's interesting to me to note that there are a few examples of such kinds of serial portraiture in photographic history. This is a work by the noted 19th century photographer F. Holland Day, and it's his 1898 serial self-portraits as Christ, suffering through the crucifixion and speaking his last seven words. Obviously, this kind of work is less about describing an individual than it is about illustrating an idea. And it was also an attempt on F. Holland Day, on his part, he was a member of the Photo Secession, in aligning photography with profound subject matter. It was an effort to establish photography as a fine art. Closer to the mark in relation to Joanne Verberg is this work by the painter Joseph Albers, who also photographed for several years and did these kinds of serial portraits. This is called Marley Hyman, All During 1 Hour, and it was made in 1933. And it bears a closer resemblance to Verberg's serial portraits in that they are individual pictures of one person at the same sitting, and they're mounted on a single support. But Albers' portraits are meant to derive their meaning from the interaction of discrete images, rather than their visual integration as they were in the Verberg pictures, although the impulse to investigate the idea of an extended portrait made over time is the same, Verberg's portraits, by contrast, achieve visual integration through the careful consideration of how each picture is seen in relation to the next, and that's certainly not what Albers was doing here. You might wonder how this work, called Still Life with Serial Killer from 1991, relates to Verberg's re-photographic survey project of 1977. Still Life with Serial Killers shows a row of commercial postcards of women's faces from paintings by Pierre-Auguste Renoir, Edouard Manet, Georges Seurat, and Paul Gauguin. And these are propped on a wall next to a waterless vase containing a rolled newspaper. And the newspaper shows the images of Charles Manson, the cult leader and mastermind of several brutal murders, and the infamous serial killer, Jeffrey Dahmer. One of Joanne's rules when she makes these pictures is that she will only use that day's newspaper. In this case, obviously the newspaper holds flowers that will eventually be placed in the vase with water. As viewers, I think, we're kept off balance, nudged both by the menacing relationships among Manson, the hulking Dahmer and the women in the beloved paintings, and by the unconventional space of the picture. We're disoriented both physically and conceptually by what is in the picture and where we stand in relation to it. We look for equilibrium. For an instant, we might imagine that women on the postcards are Manson's new band of murderers. We move between each untenable, unbelievable possibility until forced to consider ourselves in relation to this unnatural joining of art history's famous female subjects and infamous psychotic murderers, we find that reconciliation is impossible. And instead, we negotiate a process of rejection and acceptance of Verberg's subject, which is precisely the point. In its seductive way, the photograph is a provocation meant to urge us to consider not only the qualities of its divergent subject matter, but also their relation to each other, reminding us once again that there are worlds outside our world, outside the world of the photograph, once again, as seen first in the two pictures from the Rephotographic Survey Project. In fact, Joanne told me, I interviewed her extensively when I was preparing the catalog for the book, and she told me that when she was a graduate student, she memorized a poem by W.H. Auden, which is called The Musée des Beaux-Arts, and the poem opens with these lines, which I think are, she memorized it for a reason. It was a kind of inspiration for her to make art. And the poem begins, "About suffering, they were never wrong. The old masters, how well they understood its human position, how it takes place while someone else is eating or opening a window or just walking dully along." And I think that's part of the impetus for many of these kinds of pictures by Joanne, wherein she brings in the newspaper with horrific events. It's calling our attention to the fact that everything's happening all at once at the same time, which actually was a graffiti in Soho, on the walls of Soho in the 70s. I'd like to discuss one more photograph and then open to questions and comments from the audience. This picture is called Secrets, Iraq, from 1991. Which, you know, might, if you're thinking about someone drinking their coffee in the morning, this might have been a pretty benign, placid, and easily understood image, a tabletop still life featuring a cup of coffee and that day's New York Times. But she's fractured it into two views and rejoined it as a diptych. It's a puzzle that draws us in by testing our perceptions. Where are we standing in relation to what we're seeing? As we look closer, we see the figure of a uniformed soldier, it's actually a woman soldier, at the left of the picture with palm trees above her. And to the right, we see other soldiers marching at the bottom of the glass coffee cup. The interrupted newspaper text above the soldier on the left reads, quote, "troops," and quote, "why it had not," unquote, and quote, "the troops earlier," unquote. Part of the word Baghdad is visible to the right. And domestic tranquility has been rendered, but according to Verberg, quote, "the newspaper helps in this picture to suggest a world outside the frame, invisible simultaneous," unquote. A world outside the frame, invisible simultaneous, is an idea that extends her exploration of photography's elusive spaces, although made at a particular moment from a particular specific perspective and distance. A photograph alludes to a continuum of events, action and life lived outside the frame, either by the individuals in the serial portraits, as in with Michael and John in Minnesota, or three times Jim, or by the world represented by the newspapers that disrupt the haven of private life. The arrival of terrible news from distant places juxtaposes extremes of experience and also suggests their inevitable simultaneity. Lastly, I'd like to make a final comparison between Verberg's exploding triptych from 2000 and our now perhaps overly familiar Rephotographic Survey Project pictures by Jackson and Verberg. Shortly after Joanne and Jim Moore got married, they began visiting Spoleto, Italy, and in around 2000, she began making photographs in the olive groves that surround the town. exploding triptych like the serial portraits made some 20 years earlier is composed of several pictures that form a whole. And let me explain how she goes about making these multi-part pieces. She uses a 5x7 camera that requires a tripod. And for this picture, after she exposed the film for the photograph on the left, she actually, yesterday, she was talking about, she was explaining to this group how she made the pictures. She apparently started out, she realized that she wanted to make record of the picture she was exposing in the first frame. And she didn't have any tracing paper, so she used a, you know, those really thin airmail envelopes, aerograms. So she took a piece of paper that and taped it to the ground glass. And of course, if you've ever worked with a large format camera, you see what you're going to photograph when you look at the ground glass. So she has a negative that's 5x7 inches, which is fairly large. So she places the tracing paper, tapes it to the top. And what she does, one thing she does is she traces the horizon line. And then she'll trace what's on the right hand and the left-hand edges of the paper, elements that she think may be crucial when she moves the camera X amount of feet to the right or the left. She places the tracing, she has the tracing paper on still on the camera, and she's able to see what the second exposure will look like in relation to the first. And that's exactly what she did in this case. She makes all of these pictures either in the very early morning, or actually, for the most part, she makes them in the late afternoon when the light is rapidly changing and the sun's going down. And this means that she must work very quickly and very efficiently. But again, in talking about this particular piece, I think there are several things which are very important in terms of, it's not understanding it, but in thinking about it, let's say. One has to do with the scale. If you've seen the exhibition, these are fairly large. One of the interesting things we did in the installation, you know, there's a standard height at which works of art are installed in the museum, and I think it's, now it's up to 62, I think. So from the bottom of the floor to the middle of a work, it depends on the size of the work of art, but generally, it's, I think, 62 inches to the middle of the work of art. And Joanne was absolutely insistent, all the pictures come down lower, because it has to do with wanting to engage the viewer in a physical, you know, in a physical way, so that you can feel like you're stepping into the landscape. Obviously, there's more than one entry point into this picture. I mean, and the other thing that's important is that each picture, I think, can exist as a picture unto itself. And in fact, there was when she, after she made these, she had an exhibition in Minneapolis, and she produced these as postcards, not. This is one work of art, but she actually produced each individual picture as a postcard. And if you look at the one on the far right alone, it's pretty wonderful in terms of its emptiness. So I think it's fair to say, and the other issue, of course, is scale. And every single picture, I think, that Joanne's made, beginning with the serial portraits, but through these later landscapes, there is something life-size. In this picture, it may be this branch, or where this branch is the closest to us. But it could be just a configuration of three or four leaves. But it's absolutely essential, from her perspective, to make something that's life-size so that one, again, has that physical relationship to what's in the photograph. And while these three pictures were made only seconds apart, and I actually had occasion to be with her in Italy when she was making some of these pictures, and I can't tell you how quickly she has to do this because, especially in late summer, you know, the sun is like moving really fast. It's going down really fast. So she has to be extremely efficient. And while these three pictures were made only seconds apart, and the two pictures from the Rephotographic Survey Project were made 103 years apart, if we look at them together, I think that we can see how she's continued to investigate what she discovered back in 1977 with the Rephotographic Survey Project. How she can and has expanded the notion of time, what a photograph can describe, and how the viewer can be engaged by the picture beyond pure subject matter, perhaps as we see in the Cartier-Bresson. Thanks.